Good? Good morning, welcome. Great turnout, good to see all these faces for an area that I'm particularly passionate about, SDS, software-defined storage. I know it's kind of an industry buzzword, but hopefully I can kind of demystify what it is in a general sense and what it is specifically to Microsoft. Before I get too far into it, my name is Josh Adams. I'm an enterprise cloud program manager. The group I'm with, we actually specialize in customer insights. We work a lot with customers in deployments. We do pre-deployment architectures, POCs. And so with that lens, I've had a lot of face time with customers, kind of seeing directly not only what they need, but their pain points with our stack. And so hopefully when I walk through this presentation, I'm going to kind of call out some of the learnings that I've learned from customers that you guys have taught me and our company, and kind of how to navigate some of the obstacles. So with that, let's dive in. Oh, real quick, too. So this is definitely a 300-level session. So hopefully, let's quick storage spaces. Everybody has heard of storage spaces? Raise your hand, hopefully. Good. Excellent. I've given this talk, same 300-level, and some people didn't know what spaces was, which is unfortunate for me. I don't spend a lot of time high-level marketing. I kind of dig kind of deep into how do you actually design a solution. As far as Q&A, if you guys wanted to shout questions out during, if something's top of mind, feel free, or you can hold them towards the end, or come grab me after the session, whatever's best. Okay, so what I want to kind of cover during the session, I really want you guys to understand the SDS, the spaces-based SDS value prop, and I preference software-defined storage with spaces-based, as this talk is all about our software-defined storage strategy with spaces. So we definitely still have support for SANs and lots of other storage technology, but this one's definitely focused on spaces, which I don't know, people have heard of the cloud platform system solution? Okay, so people ask me, is this where Microsoft's going? Is this just kind of something that kind of jumped on and they're gonna forget? No, don't have to look any farther than CPS to know that this is Microsoft's strategic direction is spaces-based software-defined storage. We bet the farm on this technology. We're putting it in CPS, our marquee solution. So definitely this is where we're going, and we want you guys to come with us. So I'm going to showcase the proper design workflow, because it's non-trivial to set up a solution. Lots of different knobs and variables, which is a great thing, but sometimes some architects and customers kind of get lost in the weeds. So hopefully I can demystify some of that. We'll review the major spaces design pivots. There's lots of those. And then hopefully along the way, highlight some common pitfalls and workarounds that we've discovered through the last couple years of having our stack available. And then this guide, I have a little preference that I do have some smaller fonts and some equations and formulas. I designed this deck as kind of a standalone guide. So hopefully, even if you understand nothing I say here, you'll have this guide that should walk you through exactly how to design a spaces-based SDS solution. Lots of footnotes, lots of links, it's very content-laden, which I wanted to produce for you guys to actually have something to take away, other than me just rambling on. Okay, so this is the quick little overview, two slides. You know, what is spaces-based SDS? We introduced the solution back in 2012, and we further enhanced it in R2, and we've had a few sessions, I know, this week on what we're doing in vNext. But most of what I'm talking about here is applicable to R2, even though most of the design pivots will still be applicable in vNext. So this was developed directly based on customer feedback. They wanted to lower the cost of storage. Storage needs were exploding, storage costs were rising, and we got that feedback constantly from Microsoft to lower the cost of our storage. So enter software-defined storage. Let Microsoft, with the Windows Stack, own the logic, present just commodity low-cost disks, and Microsoft will layer all the logic on top of that. And it really allows, so putting all the Microsoft pieces together, and then allows for this disaggregation. So there's a term in the industry called hyperconverged, and that's a concept of putting your VMs on your storage nodes. So the storage nodes and compute nodes are one and the same. It's hyperconverged. Microsoft's strategy is different. So we have disaggregated, where you have compute clusters on one side, you got storage clusters on another side. And so we've chosen this because now, based on customer feedback, so you can scale each independently. Where if you have a hyperconverged solution, you have to scale both your storage and your compute at the same time. With disaggregated, you can scale them separately. And then what's the plumbing in between there? SMB3. So that's the protocol that we're, again, that we're betting the farm on. So the key technologies that kind of stitch us, stack together. Storage spaces on the bottom. You have failover clustering that defines your storage cluster. On top of that, you put scale-of-file servers and CSVs. And then again, the connectivity, the connection between your compute and your storage is SMB3. So what's the value prop? Flexible, low-cost storage on commodity hardware. You can buy from no vendor lock-in and using everything entirely on the Microsoft stack. So no need for any third parties. So this is kind of the overview graphic. So on the left side, again, that's kind of showing your Hyper-V clusters, disaggregation. They're connected via SMB3, so that network can be 10 gig, 40 gig, InfiniBand, to your scale-of-file server clusters, which fronts your spaces. And spaces is an abstraction layer that abstracts that low-cost commodity hardware. So, you know, JBODs. So lots of manufacturers make just a bunch of disks. We're pretty liberal in what we will support, even though we do have a software compatibility list, but there's lots of vendors that supply those low-cost JBODs. In the case of CPS is based on Dell. So Dell has a lot of JBODs that have been certified that we have a lot of good numbers on. So then the right side, that's the whole storage stack. So it starts at the very top with the SMB3, which connects your Hyper-V clusters, and I kind of show the different layers. So in this talk, we're really going to focus on the bottom part of it, the hardware decisions, the abstraction layers, the disk pools, and the virtual disks. And then higher level things, if you have questions afterwards, we can talk. But this talk, because there's so many nuances in how do you design a spaces-based SDS solution just at the lower level. How do you define all those abstraction layers? So we're going to talk on around the green dotted line. Not that everything else above it isn't important, but it wasn't not enough time to put it all in one talk. Okay, so this is something I get a lot. I probably do once a week. I have a customer design review. And oftentimes the customer comes to me, I'd say 9 times out of 10, and the first thing they say is, I need a disk subsystem that supports 500,000 IOPS. So how do I do that? And I say, okay, that's a good starting point, but let's step back a little bit and let's walk through a few other design decisions we need to make before I can actually put pen to paper and design you a solution. Because there's lots of other considerations that we need to kind of flush out. So I kind of made this flow chart to kind of help drive the conversation. And so that kind of the design workflow you need to think about when you actually design your spaces-based SDS solution. So the first step, again, the first step isn't how many IOPS do you require, even though that is part of it. It's really getting a feel for what the customer needs. What does success look like? What does a successful storage solution look like to the customer? What are their resilience requirements? For example, I've had some customers that it takes them days to replace a failed drive in their data center. So obviously resiliency, disk level resiliency is very important to them, and because if they lose a disk, they won't be able to replace for days. Where other customers, they can have disks replaced in a matter of minutes. So they're not too worried about losing disks because they can replace them right away. But it's kind of flushing those nuances out. And of course, what's their budget? You know, you throw enough money at any solution, you're going to, you know, you can get whatever you want. But true engineering is about the value prop you can, you know, the value that you want to get for the money. And that's where spaces really, really shines. So the first step is flushing out all those questions with the customer. And then you can actually do the academic exercise of taking those numbers, taking those requirements, that's what we're going to walk through today, and actually computing the number of HDDs that they need, the number of SSDs they need, the number of servers they need, how many pools, how many virtual disks, and all the different knobs. And then from there, you can go to step 3, actually deploy it and test. Step 4, of course, is validation using first probably synthetic workloads, SQLIO, disk SPD, Iometer. And then ideally, you want to get your production workloads on there as soon as possible, because I've had numerous cases where customers fully vet their spaces-based SDS solution. It runs great, synthetic workloads fly, and then as soon as they get the production workloads on it, it falls over. Why? Well, one thing in particular for example that happens probably once a month is production workloads often have flushes. So with synthetic I.O., lots of reads, lots of writes, but the I.O. profile doesn't really include some of these metadata operations. So they didn't really test the disk subsystem to really, how does it respond to flushes? So when you get in production and you're doing a lot of production workloads, a lot of metadata operations, a lot of flushes, it reacts differently. So the key point of the validation step is to make sure you're running the workload that you want to scale up in production. And then you optimize. After you validate, you're going to want to tweak. So that's your optimizing stage, and you want to go reback and evaluate. So it's, you know, it's like washing your hair, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. And once you get out of that kind of cycle and you kind of converge on the solution, then you can start staging out your production deployment and then move on to your normal maintenance. So we're going to focus on step one and step two in this talk. And again, so step two is that academic exercise. But step one, before you can get to that, is you really need to get an assessment of what your customer values, what's important to them. So I kind of came up with these arrows as a way to kind of measure the customer's expectation of what they want. So this, for example, for this customer, resiliency is extremely important. So we can use the example, this customer can't replace failed drives in a matter of minutes. It's going to be hours or days. So resiliency is very important to them. Performance, they're willing to sacrifice a little bit of performance to maintain that resiliency. They don't have a large IOP requirement, for example. Capacity, modest capacity requirements. Costs, they're willing to spend a little bit of extra money to get that resiliency. Is, of course, with all things, there's trade-offs. And that's something I really want to highlight. Every time you turn a knob in our system, you get something and you give something up. And it's not a bad thing, but I really want to expose, you know, the truth about knowing if you turn something on, what you get and what you don't get. So yeah, with additional levels of resiliency, you're going to add additional layers of cost. And then management, they're willing to, you know, retool some of the workflows. So the management interface, if you're going to use our solution with R2, you definitely need to understand PowerShell. So I mean, everything that's exposed in our spaces-based SDS stack, you can manage through PowerShell. Some of that's bubbled up in the UI, some of that's in System Center, but ultimately, investing in our stack and R2 really means you need to have somebody that understands PowerShell. So a lot of people that come from traditional SANs, you know, they're rich. They're used to these really rich, full-blown UIs and these graphical user interfaces. With R2, we don't have that. We have all that information, all the metrics, all that telemetry in the system, but you have to manually pull that out. And again, we're releasing things as we speak to help IT pros deal with our stack. But again, there's a little bit of overhead in adopting currently our value prop. So after you flush out that step one, what do they need, then you actually get down into the design pivot. So here's kind of 11 kind of high-level steps that we'll walk through. So now we first step, figure out what they need. Second step is now a paper exercise, computing what hardware they need to get to meet those needs. So the first one, the first pivot we'll talk about is storage tiering. So again, at 300 level, I didn't really go into tiering, but in R2, we have the concept of two tiers of disks. We have spinning medium, HDDs, and we have SSDs. And so in real time, there's the heat algorithm keeps track of what blocks are hot, what blocks are not, and then on the scheduled task, it's, by default, it's 1 a.m., that scheduled task will move hot blocks from the slow tier to the fast tier and move slower blocks or colder blocks back to the cold tier. So that, but it's not an inline tier optimizer. That's one thing that's different than our solution. It's real-time accounting, but kind of post-processing movement. So when people benchmark our system, the first time you run your benchmark, it's going to be different probably the second time, depending on when that optimizer runs. So it's one of the things you need to kind of consider with us is where your bits are going to be and where you want them. You know, there's concepts of pinning. You can force data to live on a certain tier if you want. But again, our optimizer is not real time. So it's something to consider. But yeah, so first one, should they use tiering or not? And then you need to calculate the number of spinning disks, the number of SSDs. The ratio of those two actually is fairly important in our system. We'll flush out why that is. Figure out the number of JBODs you need and the configuration, how many HPAs you need to support that, how many servers you need, how they should be configured. Pool count. That's the lowest level of the spaces stack of just a, you know, that's the aggregation of a group of disks. And you can decide how many pools you want. And there's lots of nuances of what happens if you have more pools or less pools. We'll talk about that. The different configuration options within the pool. Calculating the number of virtual disks. So those are, think of a LUN. So now the pool is just the aggregation of disks. And then above that, you have the virtual disks that actually the OS will see, the LUNs. So calculating the number of virtual disks you have, figuring out the configuration of those virtual disks, and then computing the sizing. Because the size of the virtual disks in our system, you can actually exceed the capacity that will allow you to do certain things in our system with different options. We'll talk about that. So there's a lot of things to kind of keep track of. Okay. Before we get into those 11 steps, the overarching design principles. The first thing is make sure your hardware is on our software catalog. I can't stress this enough that there's a lot of hardware out there, and it works in a lab environment, works in a sandbox environment. If you actually stand up on load, it just falls over. And so we have all the hardware that's been certified on the list. I definitely recommend you use that. Anything else definitely isn't supported, and your mileage will vary. Make sure all your hardware is running the latest firmware. Remember, firmware is just software. And I have a slide that shows you that now that Microsoft is owning, has direct access to those disks and those HPAs, there's nothing in the middle. That firmware is more important than ever. And so it's really important to make sure that firmware is not only up to, running the latest, but also definitely on our certified list. And then whenever possible, keep things everything symmetrical. So you have 3 JBODs, and you have 36 SSDs. Make sure you put the same number of SSDs in each JBOD and in the same slots. Make sure your scale of file server nodes are the same specs. So it helps in the design and helps in troubleshooting. So everything's consistent and symmetrical. And design for failures. You're going to have failures. Nodes are going to fail. Disks are going to fail. Before, there was a thought that, you designed against failures. But now you know things are going to fail. And if you know that, it kind of frees you a little bit to really focus on what's important. What's important isn't for making sure individual pieces don't fail. What's important is the overall solution doesn't fail. And the great thing about our stack is just lots of resiliency within the stack, but designed for individual pieces to fail. So this is an example real quick of an actual customer Quitsit we had. And they were having some performance issues. So with MPIO, that's the multipath, so you can have multiple paths to your SAS JBODs. And there's the different types of algorithms you can use. So there's round robin, which can basically saturates both lanes, or there's foo, which is failover only. So you can actually set this up in Windows and your MPIO policy. And if you look on the graph, the orange ones, is there a laser pointer on this thing? Okay, here we go. So this is 256K writes, sequential writes, and this is round robin MPIO policy with an older firmware. And then this is the foo policy. So round robin, in theory, should give you better performance than foo. But as you clearly see, at all I/O sizes, this round robin on that version of firmware just was very underperformant. And so the blue graph, this is actually the newer firmware. So now you have parity on the round robin and foo, which you would expect. So this is the difference of just the firmware on the hard disks. Now, because Microsoft doesn't make hard disks, we still rely on manufacturers for their firmware. That's why it's important now as a customer that you are responsible to make sure that firmware is updated. So that's the plug for CPS. The CPS is a pre-validated hardware solution / software solution. So all the firmware on CPS, for example, we fully vetted. When you do a DIY spaces-based SDS solution, you got to make sure the firmware is where you need it to be. And so we try our best to validate the hardware, but you got to make sure when you run your test, things like MPO policies can actually make a big difference depending on your firmware. So again, make sure your firmware is up to date, hardware certified example, et cetera. So that's the overarching design principles. Okay, the first pivot is tiering. And this one's the easiest one is it's really not a pivot. You really should use tiering. I'll be very blunt. Definitely, you're going to get the performance requirements that your customers and your partners are going to want. The cost increase is nominal compared to the relative increase in performance. So it's definitely something, if you have a 2012 system, again, tiering was introduced in R2. 2012, you don't have an option. If you're running 2012 R2, tiering is something you 99% of the time want to enable. So what happens when you enable tiering? Well, your performance increases exponentially. Your capacity, however, does go down because now you're taking out drive slots that could have 4 terabyte nearline SAS disks, and you're putting in an 800 gig SSD. So your overall system capacity is going down. So it's something to, it's one of the trade-offs. Your cost is going to go up. SSDs are still relatively expensive, although their costs are coming down dramatically. And now your management goes up too. Because now you actually do have, you have slow tiers and fast tiers. You got a task that, you know, operates at, by default again at 1 a.m. to migrate data. There's more things to, more moving parts in the system. So intrinsically, it's management overhead goes up. But typical values, yes, you should use it. And you can actually, heat optimizer is actually the engine that runs and keeps track of the heat. You can actually disable that in some cases, but for all intents and purposes, you want to keep that enabled. So use tiering, step one. So now you got to figure out, okay, how many HDD disks do I need and how many SSDs? So the first, how many HDDs? So your HDD capacity, your slow tier, that's, you design that for capacity. So it's not, that's not your performance layer. That's your sheer bulk capacity. So because we're using tiering in all our testing and all our recommendations, you don't need to use 15K drives, 10K drives. You can use the 7.2 nearline SAS drives. Typical values from, you know, 2 to 4 terabyte. Now 6 terabytes are coming on, coming mainstream. Make sure that, you know, the drives you have and all your JBODs are uniform. Don't mix and match. Is it support EDS? Is it suggested? No. So, you know, snap to one drive, one manufacturer, one firmware, and roll it out. And make sure, yeah, make sure that firmware is latest. And all these typical values I'll talk about, this is kind of the ostracized generic virtualized workload. So as with anything, it depends on your specific workload, but these are general recommendations to get you started. So now if we decide on the hard drive, what kind of hard drives we're going to use, we've got to figure out the, you know, how many we're going to actually have. So there's two ways. You know, there's storage-based, how many you need, how many drives you need to satisfy your storage requirement, and then how many you need to actually satisfy your performance requirements. And typically, your slow tier, you'll need a lot more to satisfy your performance requirement than you will for your storage requirement. And so we'll actually have an example at the end that we'll walk through this. But it takes into account, performance is pretty much, you know, what's your total size of, for example, all your VMs, expansion percentage, and the notes on this deck have all these, you see a lot of footnotes, all the footnotes explained. So expansion, a lot of people want to leave extra room. Resiliency overhead, how many copies of your data, you have two-way mirroring, three-way mirroring. This overhead percentage is something that isn't very well understood, and we'll talk about that. So spaces, every disk in a spaces environment is a metadata disk, which actually owns information about pools and virtual disks. You got to make sure you leave enough room for that. You need to leave extra room for this concept of fast rebuilds. So when a disk goes offline, when a disk goes missing, it can automatically rebuild. If you don't leave enough percentage room unallocated, you won't get that functionality. And then you divide it by, obviously, the chosen hard drive capacity to figure out how many disks you need. And then performance, you know, you need to figure out what's your IOP requirements and your slow tier. Write percentage, what's the write percentage of your workload, 30% writes, 70% reads, for example. The write penalty, again, two-way, there's a penalty for that, three-way, it's a higher penalty. And you compute that for each of your separate tiers and figure out the drive counts from there. So again, we'll walk through that. But a lot of people say, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. I think an equation is worth 10,000, kind of my scientific background. But you really kind of see the interactions between different parameters. And if I vary one, what's going to happen to the outcome? That's why I kind of like to kind of present it like this. You can kind of see what you need to tweak. And I'll jump to the end that, yeah, we'll go through some of these equations. And it looks long and drawn out. But yeah, there's going to be a sizing calculator in Excel that will do this for you. I already have this done in PowerShell that I released too. So you necessarily won't have to walk through this, but I think it's important to kind of get a baseline of what exactly we're kind of talking about. So you got to get a feel for the numbers. So that helps us determine the number of HDDs we need. Now we need to figure out how many SSDs we need. So SSDs, you're not sizing SSDs for capacity, although they do hold. They can't hold a significant capacity. You're really sizing the number of SSDs based on the performance you need. Peak performance you need from the disk subsystem. So this is your fast tier. What do you need? Yeah, if the customer wants 500,000 IOPS, you need to size the number of SSDs to accommodate that. And then there's a concept of the I/O working set. So overall, you could have terabytes of data that you're actually storing, but the I/O working set is really the blocks that are actually being used. And so ideally, and you'll see this from us, you'll see this from other vendors too, ideally you want that I/O working set, the total sum of all the I/O across all your compute, to fit inside your SSD tier. Now, that is difficult to measure, difficult to simulate, but ideally you want to size the SSDs to accommodate that I/O working set. Because if not, if your I/O set exceeds that the SSD tier, you're going to have a lot of I/Os coming from your slower tier, which will impact performance. But again, like all things, increasing your SSDs increases costs. It also allows for greater column counts. So column counts are something that we'll talk about. So unlike other solutions out there in the marketplace, our solutions, we have the concept of columns, which is, think of data striping. And the column count of one tier, say your SSD tier, is tied to the column count of the HDD tier. And so you're limited with your column count, the number of disks you can stripe across, based on the number of drives in your smallest tier, which is always your SSD tier. So a lot of times you will increase the number of SSDs you need just to get your column count higher. You don't need the added capacity for IOPS, but you need to get your column count larger so you get better performance at your HDD tier. So it's something we'll flush out too. So typical values, 200, 800 gig, MLC, you don't need SLC, pretty modest performing SSDs are fine in all our testing. Make sure they're getting their uniform, make sure they're running the latest firmware. So here, there's no capacity computation here. This is pure performance play. And one thing, same with the HDD tiers, this is kind of a hard number to get, is the rating. Typically, when you see ratings for any disks, you know, it's 100% read, 4K block size. Yeah, they look very impressive. But they're very rarely we ever have a workload that actually does those 4K, 100% sequential, 100% read workloads. So when you plug in a number here, this is the number you typically would pull off a website. This is the number that you're going to pull off from either directly testing yourself or, you know, a blog from somebody else's directly test, not marketing. So this number should definitely not be marketing. It's something that you should probably have tested yourself. Maybe, again, if you're going to order a complete SDS solution, maybe you order a few drives ahead of time and figure out what the actual IOPS are to figure out how many disks you need to order. Because, again, if you go with the values on the website, you're going to be probably undersized. Because they're always a little bit, they embellish. Okay, now we talked about the ratios. Now the previous two steps, we figured out exactly how many we need for capacity and performance. But now we have this concept of the ratio. And the reason the ratio is important, again, is this concept of column count. And so if the more SSDs you have, it gives you the ability to increase the column count and the overall disk subsystems allows you to stripe across more disks, which is important for your HDD tier. And then, again, increasing that ratio. So a lower ratio, of course, increases the capacity of your SSD tier as well, which allows a greater I/O working set size. So increasing the SSD ratio, of course, your performance is going to go up. Capacity goes down again because the capacities of SSDs are lower. But the costs are going to go up. So again, these are the trade-offs. So our recommended ratios, 1 to 4 to 1 to 6. And this isn't, that 1 to 4 to 1 to 6 isn't space-based. That's actually disk-based. So a lot of the industry, the other competitors, they have a recommendation for an SSD ratio, and that's about capacity. So typically, they recommend 10% of your capacity, typically in flash. This ratio is actually about the physical disks themselves, and why is that important, again, goes back to column count. So 1 to 4, 1 to 6. Again, all these are typical values. Mileage may vary. Enclosure config and count. So the enclosures, the JBODs, there's lots of different manufacturers out there that make enclosures. Lots of them have different port counts, different options. So you need to figure out, one, who you're going to go with and how many do you need. So we have a concept called enclosure awareness. You can actually lose an entire enclosure if you enable a feature in storage spaces. So if you have multiple enclosures, you can take advantage of that. But again, what happens if you increase the enclosure count? Well, so yeah, going back to the graph, resiliency goes up because now you can actually use that enclosure awareness. You can lose an entire enclosure and still have your system humming along. Capacity actually goes down, and that capacity, it's relative capacity per JBOD. So what happens is you need to leave a certain percentage of space unallocated in each pool. That's for that rebuild operation we'll talk about, and in each JBOD. So every JBOD you add is additional disk that you can't use. If you do use it, again, you won't get the features that we need. So there's additional overhead for every JBOD that you add. Costs, of course, go up, and the management goes up because, again, more to manage. But what do we recommend? We definitely recommend running more than one JBOD. And for a two-way or a three-way mirrored space, what are people's guesses for how many J-bods you think you would need to support enclosure awareness? So most people would say two. I need at least two. If I lose one, I still have one up. It turns out you actually need three, because the way that the dis witness works. So if you want to use enclosure awareness with two-way or three-way mirroring, you need at least three enclosures. If you want to use dual parity, which is another resiliency option, you need at least four enclosures. So that catches a lot of customers off guard too. It's two enclosures doesn't give you that enclosure awareness. You need at least three enclosures. But we still have lots of deployments with two enclosures. I mean, the odds of an enclosure going out are fairly low, but again, it's something you want to plan for. You need two or more. Different enclosures have different I/O modules, different SAS controllers. So we recommend at least two different paths going into each JBOD. Make sure the JBODs are uniform and certified. They have their own layer of firmware. Very important that the JBOD itself has up-to-date firmware. And then the disk layout within the JBOD, make sure it's symmetrical. Okay. How many enclosures you need? Well, we already previously computed the number of disks we need. Now we just figure out, okay, how many slots does our enclosure have? Enclosures typically have 12, 24, 60 disks. So this is kind of just an academic number in Roundup, of course. That's it. That figures out how many enclosures we need. So now how many HBAs do we need? So cabling. So we talked before about MPIL, the multipath. So you can actually have multiple SAS connections from each of your scale-up file server nodes to each JBOD. And so each path gives you about, using 6 gig SAS, gives you about 2.2 gigabyte a second per cable. And usually that's not the bottleneck, but if you're pushing hundreds of thousands, approaching millions of IOPS, you're going to saturate the bandwidth of one physical SAS cable, so you're going to want multipath. But adding multipath, of course, so now you actually increase performance and you increase resiliency, because you can actually lose one of those paths. Performance goes up, resiliency goes up, but now your costs, of course, go up too, because you need more SAS ports, more SAS cables, and your management now goes up too. Again, more things to manage. So typical values, we recommend at least two SAS connections coming out of each of the scale-up file server nodes to each JBOD, multiple links. SAS port speed, 6 gig is pretty standard now. 12 gig is coming on, but again, 6 gig satisfies most deployments. HBAs, one per server, latest firmware again. And this MPIO setting, this recommendation, again, it's, I would say, round robin, but you really need to test it on your workload, as we've seen that depending on the firmware and the drive manufacturers, the intricacies of MPIO and different firmwares, it varies widely from different drive manufacturers. So test that MPIO setting. It's really quick. It doesn't require a reboot. You can run a synthetic test and flip it back and forth and actually see things change. Hopefully they don't change, so check that setting. But round robin is the default. It's a good place to start. Okay, how many scale-out file servers nodes do you need to front your JBODs? So considerations are, what kind of hardware class are the servers? How many nodes do you want to lose and still stay up? So, for example, you have a two-node storage cluster. Of course, you can lose one node and still be running, but now all that workload has been shifted to one node. So where you have three, if you have three nodes and you lose one node, the loss of one node, that load can be split, half to each of the remaining nodes. So the more nodes you have, the more resilient you are to failure and to keep that SLA to the workload. So the server, we recommend at least two. You can have a cluster with one, but it doesn't give you the resiliency, to four. So CPS uses four. So two to four is ideal. And then pretty modest memory and CPU requirements for the storage servers themselves. We're not going to talk about dedupe. It's a little bit higher layer. But dedupe actually takes a lot of CPU power. So if you want to run dedupe, which isn't recommended for generalized virtualized workloads, but there are use cases, for example, VDI, that it works very well for, then you need to probably bump up RAM and your procs. Network, we definitely want you to have 10 gig, probably RDMA offloads. There's two versions of RDMA. There's Mellanox's Rocky, Chelsea's iWarp, and that basically lowers the CPU overhead of transferring traffic over the SMB3 network. So it's not really about speed, it's about that CPU offload. So RDMA, something we strongly recommend in this overall design. that every, yeah, again, everything's, make sure up to date firmwares and drivers. That's something I keep harping on. So pool counts. So this is the first, so now we've kind of covered hardware, so now this is the pool. This is the first thing in spaces that you need to decide how many pools you're going to have. So you say you have 240 disks. How many logical aggregations are you going to divide those pools up into? So pools are both a management domain and a fault domain. So a failure in one pool will affect all the virtual disks that pool actually contains. It won't affect another pool, but all the virtual disks in one pool get impacted by the loss of a disk in that one pool. So you kind of decide, okay, how many fault domains do I want amongst my disks? That being said, one of the first things you got to remember is for clustered storage spaces, what we're talking about, we don't support anything more than 80 disks per pool. So it's, from a management point of view, it'd be great if you can put all your disks into one pool. But from a supportability standpoint, we only allow up to 80. So, and the idea, if you have four JBODs, each with 60 disks, 240 total disks, you're going to have multiple pools. So every time you increase the pool, you do increase resiliencies. Now you have this isolation, this abstraction between the disks and different pools. Your performance actually decreases, goes down a little bit as you start chopping up these disks. Now you have less disks that the system can actually write against, because now it's limited to writing those virtual disks only to the disks in that pool. So as you get more pools, the system can only stripe against a subset of the disks. So resiliency goes up, more pools, performance goes down a little bit. Capacity also goes down because now, again, you have to reserve additional capacity in each pool for this fast rebuild operation. So every pool, you need to leave some amount of space unallocated so you can get your fast rebuild. So capacity goes down a bit. Costs go up because capacity went down. And your management overhead, again, goes up because you're adding additional features in the stack. So typical values, you know, if you have three JBODs, typically a lot of people use three pools. The more important number is that 80. Make sure your number of disks per pool is less than 80. And I have a graphic that actually shows up the number of disks you can lose based on the resiliency setting and the pool count. You can kind of see a little better how the interaction of the two. So once you decide on the number of pools that you need, there are a few little knobs you can actually decide on the pool itself. So the pool, again, it's a management container. It holds defaults. When you provision a virtual disk on top of the pool, there's lots of defaults that get inherited from that pool, so you can actually set those ahead of time. But more interestingly, there's a few things that you can adjust on a pool level. One is the repair policies. So it's sequential versus parallel. If you don't mind things taking a little bit longer to repair, say when you lose a disk and you don't want to impact the I/O to your workloads, you want to use sequential. But if you want to get your system back up to have, you know, full resiliency as soon as possible, you want to stick with parallel. And parallel is actually the default. But you can actually set that on the pool level. This retired missing physical disk is actually kind of an important one, as we've talked about this fast rebuild. And fast rebuild will automatically take existing space from the pool and rebuild a failed disk. So the first thing the customers do a lot of times when we do POCs, we have the system stood up, we run a synthetic workload, and the customer goes over and they pull out a disk. And like, okay, what's going to happen? And they wait for the rebuild, and they wait a little longer, and what happens? Nothing. By default, the system won't do anything. Because what happens, that disk is missing, and when you use fast rebuild, there's three settings for this retired missing physical disks, and by default it's set to auto. So if you're using hot spares, which again we don't recommend, hot spares that missing disk would automatically trigger a rebuild. With fast rebuild set to auto, it doesn't do anything, because what it's trying to prevent is thrashing of the disk, so like a transient failure. It doesn't want to kick off an expensive rebuild operation needlessly. So if you want that to happen automatically, if you want that experience where you go over and pop a drive out and you kick off that rebuild automatically, you need to change the retired missing physical disk setting to always. So then you get kind of what you expect. And actually, it's still not quite what you expect. If you set it always and the customer goes back and pulls out the disk, and what happens? Well, the way it actually works is it rebuilds 5 minutes after the first write fails to that drive. So potentially, it will still sit there and do nothing, because the system, if it's not writing to that disk, you know, it doesn't really worry about it. But if there's a write fails to the disk, it's set to always, 5 minutes later, the rebuild will kick off. So just something to keep in mind when you, these customers always like to, you know, test out the resiliency, which is important, but that's a setting you can kind of tweak. And then is power protected, I mentioned. So as I talked about before, each disk in the pool, every disk in the spaces subsystem is a metadata disk. So that means it contains information about the pools, the virtual disks. What happens on metadata operation, every disk, like on a certain metadata operations, every disk has to basically return. And is power protected basically no-ops that. So it, basically all the flushes get no-opped, all the write-throughs get return write-backs. So you definitely see a performance increase if you flip the switch is power protected. But the assumption is now your disks have their battery backed up. There's cache on the disks or on the JBODs that if power was out, it'll finish flushing those operations, because if you don't have that, you're going to corrupt your data. But it's another knob you can put on the pool level. So these, by the typical values, don't use hot spares, use fast rebuild, use the parallel default repair policy. I still recommend leaving the retire missing physical disk to auto. But again, if you want that automatic rebuild, switch that to always. And then typically don't use is power protected, but it's, again, some customers have come to me and they say, well, in my data center, I have data coming from two different power plants, two different grids. It's not battery backed up, but the probability of power going down is, you know, approaching asymptotic to zero. So they go ahead and use that, and they get, you know, they see a significant bump in performance. So it's, you know, they're willing to, if something did happen, they're willing to deal with the data corruption issue. So your virtual disk. So now we've decided how many pools we have. Now in each pool, we have to decide how many virtual disks we're going to carve those up into. So if you think a little bit higher up the stack, so ultimately you've got your Hyper-V cluster, and so you're pointing your Hyper-V, your VHDX files over SMB to different shares. And so in your scale of file server nodes, you're exposing SMB shares. And so the ratio of the SMB share to the underlying CSV volume, which is then backed by a virtual disk, is 1:1:1. So the number of SMB shares you want to expose to your Hyper-V clients, that's the number of virtual disks that you want to get. So that's kind of the first pivot. It's a 1:1:1. And know that, too, every time you create a virtual disk, so in tiered storage spaces, not only do you have the ability to move the hot blocks to the fast tier and the cold blocks to the cold tier, there's a write-back cache. And now in tiered spaces, all the writes under, I think, 128K actually hit the write-back cache. So it's, you know, very, very high performance for the writes. And each time you create a virtual disk, there's a dedicated cache for the virtual disk. So the more virtual disks you create, the more dedicated cache you have in the system. So all things being equal, that's going to improve your performance a little bit. But of course, increasing that virtual disk count is going to increase your management overhead, more things to manage. But then increasing the virtual disk now allows you to, when you do have a failure in a node, you can more granular fail over that workload of the node. So if you have, say you had two virtual disks per node, so you had three nodes, if you lose one node, now, you know, one of those virtual disks can go to, say, node A, and the other one could go to node B. But if you had four virtual disks per node, so say 12 total, and you had, you know, four different scale file server nodes, now you can take those four virtual disks and sprinkle them across all different nodes. So it's a level of granularity when you have a failover. So again, design for failover. The more virtual disks you have, you can spread that resultant load with the down node. And know that you're going to have scheduled updates. You're going to bring nodes offline, so that workload's going to have to be shifted over, at least in your maintenance window. So it's, again, something to plan for. But as you increase the virtual disk count, resiliency goes up, performance goes up a little bit because you talked about the right bit of cache, capacity stays about the same, and management goes up a little bit, more things to manage. So typical values, at least 2 to about 4 virtual disks per your scale-out file server nodes. If you have 3 scale-out file server nodes, you know 6 to 12 is reasonable. Okay, this is the chart I was talking about. So this is the virtual disk configuration. So the first thing you want to decide, what kind of parity settings you want. So in R2, for virtualized workloads, we only recommend mirrored. So you kind of forget about the dual parity for now. And so with mirroring, you have two options, two-way or three-way. Do you want 2 copies of your data or 3 copies? And so moving from 3-way, of course, doubles the number of disks you could lose. And so this kind of showcases how your pool count interfaces with the resiliency setting. One, to kind of see how much overhead you have, but two, how many disks you can lose in the system. So if you had a group of say 240 discs, again, you can't put more than 80 in a pool, but if you put all 240 discs in one pool and you had two-way, you could only lose one disc before you're at risk of data loss. So that's why the pools that fault domain is very important to define, because that gives you the ability to lose more disks throughout the system and still maintain your resiliency level. So your pool count, and then with your resiliency level on your virtual disk, you can kind of compute how many disks you can lose in your system before you're at risk of losing data. And again, hopefully, as soon as you lose a disk, if you have the unallocated space, you'll have that rebuild operation take place, and you won't be in the situation. But this is kind of the worst case, the number of disks you can lose if they're not being rebuilt. So going from two-way to three-way, your resiliency definitely increases. TPS employs three-way almost everywhere it has mirroring. It also has some spaces that are dual parity. But it definitely, the pivot on CPS with three-way, it's definitely something we encourage. Performance goes down because now you're actually, when you have your write, you have to write three places in three-way versus two-way. So there is a higher write. Oh, question? Oh, sure. Sure. So the question was about the write penalty in two-way and three-way, why it's there. So the write penalty is just the number of IOPS. When we talk about write penalties, it's just the number of IOPS total that the system has to endure. So it's because now with two-way, there's two writes versus three-way, there'd be three writes, and simple would be one write. So that's the penalty. It's just the overall IOPS that the number spread across all the disks. System-wide, yeah, exactly. Not disk, yep, not disk level. So kind of the overall system, yep. Yeah, thanks for the clarification. So yeah, so typically two or three-way, but we usually recommend three-way, knowing that your capacity is going to go down because now you have in a sense, a 67% overhead because you have three copies of all the data, and your costs are going to go up subsequently. Because that's why it's so important to get a feel for how important is resiliency. As you can see, there's kind of a constant trade-off between resiliency costs and performance. And so it's important to understand where the customer is on resiliency and performance. Okay, column counts. We talked about this. Column counts are the number of disks you can think about that the data is striped across. So think about the larger this number, the better to a point. Because what happens is, as you stripe across, say a dozen disks, now you depend on all those disks to basically return, say in a metadata operation, a flush, to return acknowledgement that they've actually done that. And the more disks you have to wait for, the more chances you're going to get some of the latency tails. And so with higher column counts, sometimes you do run into some latency issues. So our typical values we recommend from 4 to 6. And to get to 4 to 6, you have to make sure, going back to the number of SSDs, you have enough SSDs that you can actually get the proper column count, going back to the equation we had. And so the way you compute the column count depends on the number of data, so it depends on your resiliency setting. So physical data redundancy, that's for two-way mirror, that's 1. For three-way mirror, you have two redundant disks. And the number of data copies, for two-way, it's 2, and for three-way, it's 3. And then, so this is the disk count in the smallest tier, so typically it's always your SSD tier. So that this will compute the maximum number of columns that you can actually provision. Now, if you provision through the UI, you don't get an option for the column count. It'll compute it for you up to a maximum of 8. To expose the number of columns, if you want to set that yourself, you have to go through PowerShell. And that's true with a lot of these settings, that they're only accessible via PowerShell. And there's one kind of caveat, that if you do provision the max column count, the problem is if you lose a disk in that pool, now that fast rebuild, the problem is you don't have enough disks in that pool now to support the column count of your virtual disk. So even if you have that unallocated space in your pool, you won't get the fast rebuild because now the system doesn't have enough disks to maintain that column count. So typically you want to figure out your maximum and potentially reduce it by 1 so you can still maintain that your column count in your virtual disk. So other options now on the virtual disk layer, what's kind of interesting, the interleave, that's basically the stripe size that you're writing across, you want to make sure that's larger than kind of your largest IO, your kind of dominant IO. So 256K is a typical recommendation that we do. The write-back cache size. So a lot of customers love the concept of write-back cache. They're so glad that we have that now in R2. And by default, we make 1 gig. We're like, hey, I got lots of memory, lots of space. Let's make it 10 gig. Let's make it 50 gig. Well, the issue is in cluster spaces, so that's what we're talking about here. When you have a node failover, what happens to the write-back cache? It has to be destaged and then restaged on another node. So the larger the write-back cache size grows, the longer that destaging takes. And if it takes too long, you're going to have timeouts, which will then reverberate throughout the stack and cause problems. So in all our testing, our recommendations, the sweet spot we found, which is the default, is 1 gig. So we don't recommend customers ever going above that. I know customers are still going above that. And potentially on their workloads, it's working great. But the recommendation, the 1 gig default, that's why we have that. Not because we can't go higher, but because of that, you know, we're cognizant of the whole stack and knowing that if it gets too big, those kind of failover destaging times take too long. And then other pieces of the stack, they don't get as happy. So yeah, keep that as 1 gig typically. And then is enclosure aware? This is your chance to basically say that this virtual disk has disks, is on a pool that is allocated across different JBODs. So you can actually set your virtual disk to have a switch and say, yes, this virtual disk is enclosure aware. You can't set that again in the UI. You got to set that in PowerShell. But if you have for two-way or three-way mirroring, if you have three or more JBODs, definitely employ enclosure awareness. If you're using dual parity, you need four enclosures. But it's something that allows you then to lose an entire JBOD. The virtual disk size. So this is kind of where it all comes together, is how big can I now make my virtual disk? And there's lots of data here, but this kind of shows you all the different nuances in the stack itself. Like this is, maybe this one's worth about 100,000 words. But this is the way you compute your virtual disk tier size for each of your virtual disks. So your virtual disk consists of two things, your SSD and your HDD. So this equation, you want to compute each of those independently. So this is your disk size of one specific tier. Say we're doing your SSD tier. So there's minus 1 gig. This is why. So that's the metadata overhead. We want you to reserve 1 gig from every disk in the system for the space's metadata. And now here, the JBOD count times the disk size plus is 8 gig. This is the rebuild capacity we want you to leave for every JBOD. So this equation highlights the fact that, you know, you want to make sure you don't provision a certain amount of space to allow that fast rebuild to happen. And how much? Well, one disk plus 8 gig times the number of JBODs. And then, of course, you want to leave room if you're doing your SSD tier for write-back cache. And then this is the number of data copies and the number of virtual disks you actually want to create. All this data we've computed previously. And then this little number of columns, times number of columns with the floor, that's a little nuance of the way that internally it rounds up the slab sizes. And this is a way to kind of keep track of that, making sure that basically round down. So it's relatively a conservative value, even though it gets you pretty close to the maximum. So you may want to back that up. But that computation allows you to not only now understand, okay, what's the system doing? What do I need to leave? But how big can I provision? And again, there's going to be an Excel spreadsheet for this. There's going to be scripts already done. So you don't really need to worry about computing it. It's kind of fun doing it a few times, I must admit, but you guys don't need to if you don't want to. And all the footnotes, you guys will have this deck. But that's where you compute your virtual disk size. So that pretty much takes us through the 11 steps that we talked about at the very start of where the paper exercise of designing the spaces-based SDS. So after now, we can go actually order that hardware based on what we just designed, and then we can actually start doing our testing and POC. So here, actually deploying it. Here, you're doing your synthetic workloads. You're optimizing, going back and forth, and slowly rolling out your production workloads based on successful iterations. So that's the overall flow chart of how to do the system. And going back to step one, that's the most important step. It's not the paper exercise, which is a lot more interesting. But it's really getting a feel from the customer of what's important to them. What's performance? Again, they always start with, I need half a million IOPS. No talk of resiliency, no talk of cost. So you kind of got to pull those out, kind of tease those things out. So with that, So let's take all these kind of abstract concepts and let's put it together with an example customer. And this is actually a customer that no names mentioned, but a walkthrough I did with them using their actual environments and constraints that they had. So again, step one, the solution requirement assessment. What do they need? So for them, it was days before they could get to their data center to replace disks. So enclosure awareness, being able to lose entire JBOD, lose lots of disks, very important to them. They're willing to pay for that. So the cost, they're willing to pay for that. Resiliency was the most important thing. Performance, yeah, they don't want a laggard system, but they were willing to take a little hit on performance for the sake of resiliency. Capacity, modest capacity requirements, and they're willing to pay for the resiliency that they needed. And yes, they had the management chops to kind of do a little bit of the tooling themselves. So they had their vendor had some hard disk sizes that they had, and they had some published numbers, but they went ahead and ran their own IOPS tests on these disks. So much different than, again, they had to, if you took these numbers, you'd have to extrapolate and it'd be so much higher than these numbers, but they had some actual read-write IOPS of these disks. Same thing with SSD drives. They had a list of drives that they could pick from, and they had the published spec 120,000 IOPS. When they actually tested it with their workload, 7,000. So you definitely want to avoid the published numbers. So they went ahead and took these disks, did their own test, had these numbers. The JBOD enclosures they had, they were 60 disk JBOD enclosures, and each one had two I/O modules. So after several conversations of figuring out what they needed and what their preferred vendor can supply, step one, then you can move into the actual paper exercise. But most of the time is kind of sped up front, kind of figuring out what they needed. And again, this is a customer came to me that said they wanted 200,000 IOPS. That was the first statement. Well, after many conversations, it turned out, well, what was most important was resiliency. I mean, IOPS it's moot if the system is down. And so after conversation with them, they were willing, okay, let's focus on resiliency and maybe throw a little bit more money at it to get the performance up. So initial pivots based on their, this customer's IOPS requirements, 100,000 IOPS peak, so your SSD tier, and then they still wanted their HDD tier, 10,000 IOPS to be, fairly significant. And their capacity, 1,000 VMs at 40 gig each with about a 15% reserve. Oh, yeah, and the workload, 64K random IOPS, they kind of just did some simulations in their Hyper-V environment. And so these IOP numbers here correspond to their workloads. So this workload they had, and they then benchmarked their drives with that IOP profile to figure out what the drives can actually do. So tiering, no-brainer. Definitely going to use tiering. Get the write-back cache, get SSDs, get that automatic moving back and forth. Resiliency, you can probably figure out that they definitely wanted a three-way mirroring. So really only have two options, again, two-way, three-way. They were going to go three-way. And the disk collection, they went with the 4-terabyte nearline SAS and the 800 gig MLC. That's fairly common kind of convergence there. And so how many HDDs do they need to order now? So they computed, going back to our equations, with some actual numbers. So their net data footprint, their 40 gig VMs, they had 15% expansion capacity. This overhead percentage, this is kind of just right now a spitball, 12%. That's with that metadata. That's with the fast rebuilds. That one is kind of just a fudge factor we'll go back and figure out. But bottom line, when you design for storage, it's usually much less than what you'll need for performance. So they only need 22 of these disks to actually accommodate their storage. But then based on their 10,000 IOPS requirement for the HDD tier, the computation is quite a bit different. And this is using their actual, their IOPS read performance, IOPS write performance. It turns out they need 136 of these disks. So again, quite a bit greater than the storage-based. So they're going to have lots of capacity, lots of room to grow. Okay, so now the SSDs. How many SSDs do they need? So here, they're not designing for capacity. They go right to, okay, we want to make sure we can support 100,000 IOPS. So based on their read-write profile, which I believe was 70% read, 60% read, 40% write, and the different IOPS for each one, turns out they need 32 SSDs and the entire solution to support that 100,000. Okay, so they have that number, and then the ratio. So again, we were talking about the ratios of, you know, 1:4 to 1:6. By default, their ratio right now is, you know, 1:4.25. So it's, yep, right in there. And then this enclosure count, pretty simple number of disks total, divided by the 60 disk JBODs they have. Yep, turns out rounds up to 3. So they need at least 3 JBODs, which works out well because they want enclosure awareness, which needs more than 2. So the numbers actually worked out pretty well. So the enclosure layout. So this is where it gets a little bit, going back to the symmetry, and you want things symmetrical. Sometimes you need to round up or subtract a little bit to make sure your math works out right. So we actually increase your SSDs to 36. And they wanted to fully populate the JBOD, so they actually went with 144 HDDs. So now they can fill up three entire enclosures. And then the ratio works out to be the magic number of 1.4, or 1:4. So this is just kind of a paper mathematical exercise. These increases weren't due because the system needed it. It was due basically because how the system was laid out and the math of actually dividing number of pools. You want to make sure you have nice even numbers on column counts, for example. And so again, this is step two. You're going to go back when you actually do your validation and that optimization, that iteration on the flowchart. You might go back here and change some of these numbers, which is perfectly fine. This is just trying to figure out what they need to order. And in every case, they round up just to make sure they're not going to be underperforming. Cabling, they definitely want to use multipath to get the resiliency that they want. And then the server count they want, they could have, for their IOPS and their IOPS requirements and the overhead on those storage servers, 2 would have been just fine. But again, the problem is with 2, you're always going to have updates, you're always going to have patches. That means one server is going to be going down. That's even without failures. So that's why what's the old saying? 2 is none, 3 is 2. And this, what is it? 2 is none. Well, the point is, 3 allows you to have 1 offline for your maintenance and still have 2 up all the time. So now you can still actually have a failure. You have one down plan for maintenance, 1 can actually fail and you're still up. So again, 2 would have been fine on paper, but they went to 3 because again, resiliency was so important to them. So pool count. How many pools, how many SSDs? So they did a quick back of the envelope calculation. They have 180 total disks. They can put 80 in each one. So they need, over 2 pools. So it works out to be 3, which works out to be kind of nice given their 3 JBODs. So because they have 3 now, you divide the number of SSDs and HDDs. So they have 48 and 12 in each of the pools. So again, this is important now. We're dividing all those disks into separate fault domains, but now we don't get a write across all our disks. So now we have to be cognizant of how many disks we have left in the pool as we carve up the virtual disks. We got to make sure we have enough spindles to basically write across to keep the performance up. So pool config, they're not going to use hot spares. They're going to use the fast rebuild that we talk about. They're going to make sure they don't allocate the full pool, so they get that automatic fast rebuild. The repair policy, they want disks repaired as soon as they fail. They're going to keep it parallel. They're going to take a little IO hit on that, but they're willing to do that. Retire missing physical disks. They want, if a disk gets pulled out or if a disk gets offline, they want it to rebuild right away. So they're going to flip that from auto to always, like we talked about. And is power protected? They don't have that level of power redundancy, and they don't need the performance that would provide. So they're going to use the recommended value of false. Virtual disk count, because they have the three servers, they're just going to go the standard, we recommend 2:4 granularity. They opted more for the 2 per node, which gives them a total of the 12. Actually, no. Yeah, 2 per the 3, so they have 6 total. If they would have went with, say, 4 per node, so 12 is just, again, more maintenance for that them to have to worry about, so they just said, let's just stick with 2. So now with 3 nodes, 2 actually works out pretty well, because if one node fails, it has 2 virtual disks that it owns. Now each of the remaining nodes can handle one of the virtual disks. So again, the numbers work out pretty well. Virtual disk config, so the resiliency, they went with 3-way mirroring as opposed to 2. Their interleave, they kept the default. And some of these topics, we're talking about interleave, and I have lots of links you guys want to go further into some of these items too, and I'm not going into all the details. Redback Cash, you're going to leave that at 1 gig as per our recommendation. And Enclosure Aware, they are going to flip that bit, and they're going to say true, as they want that. So that means they're going to have to use PowerShell to provision these virtual disks. You can't flip that Enclosure Awareness bit in the UI. And so the column count, they just want to figure out, okay, now based on the number of pools I have now and the number of disks left in those pools, what's my max column count? So based on the resiliency setting they have and the number of disks in that smallest tier, which was 12 SSDs, so their max column count is 3. But they probably shouldn't use 3 because they're really concerned about, they want that auto rebuild, they want to be able to lose a disk and still have that disk come back up. So they're probably going to use 2. And I said before that the recommend value is 4 to 6 ideally. Based on their testing, 2 turned out to be just simply adequate, so it was 2 wasn't something they were worried about. So, but they computed 3 was fine, and they went with 2. So now going back to the virtual disk sizing, so this is the important step of making sure you don't allocate all your space. So the SSD tier, again, I have the overall equation up here, that's the size in gigabytes of the SSD disks. Again, you have the 1 gig metadata overhead. Here's the number of JBODs times 1 disk plus 8 gig, all the other numbers. So it works out, you have 1.1 terabyte. That's the SSD tier. When you actually create your virtual disk, and I'll show you this real when we get to a demo, that number you'll actually feed into the PowerShell commandlet. You actually say, when you create that virtual disk, how big you want each of the tiers to be. So you'll take these numbers directly and put them into PowerShell. And then the same thing with the HDD tier, quite a bit bigger. But you can figure out, how big to make it, but without exceeding that reserve capacity you want to make sure you keep. So this is kind of how it looks graphically, the way they laid it out. So the way their pools are laid out, 3 pools. There's a piece of the pool in each JBOD. And all the different numbers that actually worked out. You'll know the storage overhead. So they use 3-way mirroring, which innately has, a 2/3 overhead. And there's additional overhead because they're using fast rebuild. So that in each space, in each pool, there's additional free space that they have to leave for that fast rebuild. So that's why their storage overhead jumps up a little bit past the 67%. And customers first look at that and think, well, that's a lot to be left on the table. But again, this customer, resiliency was very important for them. So they were willing to invest in a solution that really had a lot of that resiliency. And so that was, so now at this point they can go and they can call up their manufacturer and say, here's my bill of materials, and they can go on further along that design process. And so again, kind of tying it back to, is Microsoft committed to spaces-based SDS? And again, CPS is the architecture that we are recommending everybody kind of snap to, whether you purchase CPS or you build it yourself. And CPS has 100% is based on spaces-based SDS. So all the pool designs, they have 4 JBODs, they have 3 pools. I mean, all the different design pivots that we just went through, the engineering team went through themselves. And they spent a year iterating on that design. A lot of those learnings now are presented back to you as the typical value. So this is kind of the marketing slide that they gave me to throw in this deck. But CPS, but I wanted to kind of tie it back that, spaces-based SDS isn't just this, dangling red-headed stepchild in the corner. It's definitely a strategic part of Microsoft's overall story and strategy. So now let's switch real quick to a demo. My machine logged me out real quick, okay. And so this demo I did promise that you guys wouldn't have to go through all those calculations yourself. And so I do have a slide that I'll show you that actually will link to, I have a TechNet gallery page, which I have some scripts I put up there. And so that sizing calculator that will basically take all this and allow you to kind of do some different iterations and kind of pivot on performance and price, and that'll be put up there. It hasn't been developed yet. And then the script that I'll show you right here, that'll be up there too. So here's a function, get optimal tier size in gigabytes. It basically takes your disks and all the different parameters of the virtual disks and number of JBODs, and it computes, basically takes that equation we had, the longest equation we had, and figures out the max capacity for each of your tiers. And then this new optimal spaces function, it basically takes a list of disks, figures out, it calls that compute optimal drive size. Here's the actual create the new virtual disk. So this is actually calling, we give it the name of the pool. Here's actually the sizes. So this is why it's important. So this commandlet, it needs to know how big should I make these tiers. And so that's why we have the, we have our equation that computes that. In this case, I have a function that computes that for us. So we're resiliency setting, and we have mirror. So this actually, that example I just did, this is the PowerShell equivalent of it when I run this. Interleave, number of columns, again, all the stuff you can't set in the UI, you have to set in PowerShell. Enclosure where, makes it, it's true. And then, so here's, this actually just calls it. It's gonna create this optimal spaces. It's gonna create the virtual disks and get the pool info. So right now, let's just run this. Okay, so right now, this was important, is I actually gave it a list of disks from each JBOD. So basically, from slot 33 to 52 in each JBOD, I knew there was a certain number of SSDs and a certain number of HDDs. So it was very symmetrical. So I could, in this, so you look right here, I have 16 HDDs and 4 SSDs in each one of my enclosures, enclosure 0, enclosure 1, enclosure 2. So that's kind of a check to see, okay, so I have a symmetrical layout. I know that I have 16 HDDs in each enclosure and 4 SSDs. So right now it's actually creating that pool, so it's aggregating those all together in that kind of logical abstraction, which is a fault domain and a management domain at the same time. Okay, so it creates that. Now it's actually creating those. So now it's computing. So you'll notice that these numbers are exactly the same numbers that we computed earlier on the PowerPoint. So that good validation of the script and the math, and I didn't get that right the first time, so I had to fix that last night. And now you can actually see, okay, here's the virtual disk info, here's the two that we have. And now if you look back at the pool info, you can see, okay, the total size of this pool that I made, so I have three pools, the total size, 183, and now with these two virtual disks, this is how much I've allocated. And of course, this allocated takes into account the three copies, and this is my unallocated space. And that's what we want. We want to make sure we have enough unallocated space, which is, again, non-trivial to kind of to figure out without kind of a prescriptive equation to make sure we have our fast rebuilds. So I would have ran the next thing on that pool I just made, but the formatting of those virtual disks was taking a few minutes. So I had prepared another pool, exact same configuration, which I'll show you. And then what we'll do, we'll actually run a disk SPD, which is a benchmarking utility, and I have a link to it. So before, we always recommended using SQLIO up to about a month ago. That was the only thing that Microsoft had released publicly. But internally, we were using disk SPD for, I'd say, the last 6-7 years. And so we finally got that actually open sourced and now actually released to the public. So I have a link to it, too. It's actually, I released it on my TechNet Gallery account. So I'd highly recommend using disk SPD. So we're going to run that against the two pools that we created, well, the two virtual disks we created. And what I did beforehand, so I created two test files. So disk SPD, just like SQLIO, runs against test files. And so what happens is when you create a file in tiered storage spaces, the exact allocation of where that file is somewhat non-determinant. So if you test a file that you just create, you don't know if you're writing to the file that's on the SSD tier or the HDD tier. Now, once the optimizer runs, the hot blocks are going to be moved to the fast tier, and the cold blocks are going to move to the slow tier. But when you first kind of do a benchmark like this, I use the concept of pinning. So I pinned one file completely to the HDD tier and the other file completely to the SSD tier. So now when I benchmark against these files, I know exactly what disks I'm running against. So I have two files, they've been pinned. And the way you pin them is just, let's see, I actually pin these right here. So the set file storage tier, again, there's quite a few demos that kind of demo pinning. But for the purpose of this, I've already pinned them. And then we're going to invoke this inspection, this disk SPD. Again, just looks like SQLIO. You specify a block size, number of threads, IOs, and again, there's lots of documentation about this. It's great utility. So we're going to run it twice, once against the file that's pinned to the SSD tier, and once it's pinned to the file to the HDD tier. So I run this. So again, the pool info, just to make sure you know that I'm not doing anything. Smoke and mirrors is exactly the same allocated size, unallocated size of the pool we just created. Exact same configuration. Now we're running the SSD against the, or the disk speed against SSD tier. I did 10 seconds. Of course, this is, you should run it for longer and warm it up. And this is just kind of a quick check of our calculations. We designed the tiers to have certain performance characteristics. So now it's kind of, you can see what exactly we're getting back from these tiers. So this is actually this ACD tier. So we're getting about 6,000 IOPS on this run. I've seen it vary from 4,000 to 7,000. And so again, our original design was for 10,000 for the entire system, and this is now 6,000 for one virtual disk and one pool, and we have three pools. So extrapolating that value, so we should be well beyond where we wanted to be for HDDs. That could be because I maybe underestimated the number of IOPS originally. Again, I was trying to be conservative, so potentially if I wanted, looks like maybe I could probably reduce the number of HCDs if I just really want to make sure I only hit that that 10,000 level. But again, we increased, we wanted to fill our JBODs up, the customer wanted to fill the JBODs up, so they added JBODs just to fill up their system. So that's why we're seeing the better than expected performance there. And if I go to the SSD tier, 81,000. So again, remember, we added a lot of extra SSDs, not for performance, but to get that ratio up and to get that column count in the HCD tier higher. So again, this is for one virtual disk and one pool. So you could take this number, theoretically, times it by six, and that's where and we only want 100,000, so we're well beyond that. So again, if this customer wanted, it was very price conscious, now potentially they can go back and kind of retweak and do that reiteration. This is a quick way to kind of validate what they had and what we went through. So key takeaways, hopefully this all resonates. I know I'm out of time here. Related content, here's some other, some of these are going on, already went on, some of them are going on right now. If you have any questions for me, you can come up after this, or I'll also be ask the experts tomorrow night. Here's some Technic content, again, all this stuff, links. Here's where that sizing calculator and those scripts will be. That's the link to that. Additional resources, boilerplates, good stuff, other good stuff. They've added a lot of slides here. Okay, evaluations. Hey, your input is important. It'd be great if you could give me some eval. But more importantly, yeah, I hope you guys walk away from this having a better understanding of what the spaces-based SDS solution is, what it's about, and how to design it. There's lots of nuances in that lower portion, and hopefully I kind of lifted the curtain a little bit on the underneath underpinnings of the solution. So thanks for coming.